It's nice to have this rain again. It's telling us, I'll come back. I won't go away. It's my nature to come back. So it's nice to see it back again. It really changes my perception of the environment, of maybe all phenomena. I've been using this image of the breath feeling like it's a little thicker, like nectar, breathing in and out, nectar. And this morning, walking around the Jundo, the floor just felt so soft, you know, like I was stepping into a little quarter inch of felt all along the way. And also, it was like I was on one of those moving sidewalks at the airport. It seemed like I had to do no effort at all, and I was just around the room. It reminds me of my short time in Tassajara. It was a short time. I was just there one practice period. But I've got a lot of memories. And it was, you know, I was there in the winter time, and going into the bathhouse there early in the morning when it's still cold, and there's a layer of frost along the decking to the door, or all the decking, but you walk on it quite a distance to get to the door of the bathhouse. And that too feels soft. It feels icy cold and plush at the same time. It was a great sensory experience. So this weather that is so welcome and seems like it's been gone for such a long time seems to be changing my perspective. And of course, I want to give credit to our sitting. Changes our perspective, changes how we see things. So this kind of moving, carpeted, nectarish space that I find myself in, I'm thinking maybe I've just, in this sitting and letting my old habits drop away little by little, I've given my senses a chance to do something different, a chance to feel things differently, a chance to taste things differently. So I think that's part of the causes and conditions of my kind of sensory shifting, shape-shifting experience these last few days. You know, in another thing in that vein is that when we sign up for practice period, many of us here have been in the practice period for the last 7 weeks. This is the last week. This is week number 8 of the practice period. So almost 2 months, many of us have been in the practice period. And I think when we sign up and we practice maybe a little bit more and we do other practices, the outcome is that our big mind is kind of forward, is kind of on the front burner. We're acting out of big mind, and certainly that's a piece of sesshin as well. Big mind was maybe Suzuki. Maybe it was a term that Suzuki came up with. I could be wrong about that. But, big mind is not so different than what we've been looking at as the undying person in the hut, or our Buddha nature. So we're kind of dwelling in, or our original self. We're kind of dwelling more in our original self, or aware of Buddha nature in our actions, and we're acting out of this big mind that also has qualities like harmony, interconnectedness, compassion, open-heartedness. Our hearts maybe are more open. Nothing left out. We have the whole works in this big mind. All of our energy and awareness is there. Those are the things that I think come out of turning up the volume of practice some egolessness, so it's we're not so directed by the ego, but really involved and really aware of how we're eccentric. We're not the center, we're just this wonderful connected part. So that's I think what arises with our practice and practice period and then of course sesshin. Sesshin is this wonderful kind of mutual dance and mutual art expression, where we're just all moving together with our bodies, with our minds, with our hearts. We're aware of when small self pops up, like, ooh, the soup is too hot. And then we just put that soup bowl down and we go on to the salad that we can start off and eat with everybody right away and then get back to that soup. Oh, just right. Little Red Riding Hood appears in our story. And the services that we're doing together, the chanting to the Mokugyo, syllable by syllable, all in harmony. So we enact this harmonious big mind in sesshin, and we're aware when small mind comes up, not particularly an intrusion, not particularly an unskillful thing, when when small mind, when the ego shows up, we just sort of note that, oh, Patrick has a preference for the soup a little colder, a little less hot. And we then join the flow already in progress. That's I think our big mind practice. I've got some examples that most of you are tired of hearing me bring up, but I can't do it. Maybe because I think they're so good, and I'm not creative enough to come up with other examples. But you know, we can be totally, you know, thinking about car repair as we walk down Pacific Avenue, and we'll see this kind of crying child, and all of a sudden, maybe, and this, the reason I, these are two experiences that really opened me up and felt that I was now kind of reacting out of big mind, but you know, this crying child just opens up my heart and I say, I know that mind, I know that disappointment, I know when I'm about to cry, and I'm now very connected with this great human experience. And not only, you know, am I connected now with this kind of stranger right here, but all of the human experience. I feel connected now, where before I was in my mind of, you know, planning when to bring the car in, and I have to get this done first, and you know, kind of the way we maneuver ourselves so that it works out well for us. I switch from that to just, I'm connected with the whole works here. And, you know, my other example is that, I was on a Dharma walk with Richard Kolmar and in Nicene Marks, and just coming over the ridge and seeing the whole expanse of forest and really feeling a part of all of the Indra's net, all of the parts that are involved in this forest. And I wasn't this outsider in the forest. My first impression was I wasn't even thinking I, but I was just very connected in here. So another example for me when big mind arose. We then, for a while, we act out of that big mind. Our actions come out of the condition of interconnection or intimacy. When we sign up for a thing like practice period or sesshin, I think we're more aware of that original self or the big mind or the Buddha nature or this undying person in the hut that is always us and always others, and we see the non-separation of self and other, and the floor changes its quality. It's not it's not just this hard thing that keeps my feet off the dirt. It becomes this kind of living thing. That's just my conjecture right now. I can't be quizzed on that one. But it just doesn't seem right now to be separate, that my change in perception from big mind to this movable floor. Catherine was always one of her teachings was just be aware when Patrick shows up. Just be aware when the ego enters the room. And it was a mindfulness practice, and a mindfulness practice is not to be critical, like, oh, the ego shouldn't be in the room. Just be aware. I mean, the ego kind of got me here on time. The ego, I had to set my alarm. The ego is not the polar opposite of big mind, but just to be aware of when the ego needs to be front and center, and then can we then sort of also meet big mind again, and act out of big mind I don't know about that. Can we act out of big mind with also some skills of the ego? The ego can certainly act in a skillful way. Can we be aware that this is me speaking, not Catherine? Can we be aware of the dance that is always going on between the ego and big mind? And make sure that there's always two people dancing together in the room. I'm riffing on that one. Bodhidharma, in his lecture called The Essence of Bodhi of Mahayana Teachings or Outline of Practice, talks a little bit about this, especially in, he said that many roads lead to the path, but basically there are only two, reason and practice. And under the practice category, he gives us four practices. And number three is seeking nothing. And I'm just going to say that the seeking part is kind of an ego-driven activity. You know, mainly we seek so that we can acquire something that will be kind of like money in the bank of this ego, oh, now I know this. I can check that off my list. I've got that now. That knowledge is mine. Then there's no need for me to put it in such a sinister way even. Seeking belongs in the ego realm. And I think in our practice, which Bodhidharma, I think, says, and certainly one of our contemporary teachers says that we, when we practice, we meet the truth, and rather than seek the truth, or maybe we start off seeking and it's something different than we thought, and we actually meet something else. But let's hold that, because I've been putting off kind of just talking about Bodhidharma himself. And I joked that that not so much is known. And so this introduction to Bodhidharma, where we learn everything about Bodhidharma, will be very short. And that a lot of it is in the mythical realm, which are kind of fun. It's kind of fun too. So we'll like Alice in Wonderland, where the floor is moving. We'll go into that realm for a little bit. You know, there probably was this this great teacher who came from India and settled in China, maybe in the late part of the 400s of the Common Era here, maybe later in the 500s. And this teacher of, this was kind of he really was teaching Zen, or pointing directly at the mind, which was a little different than some of the other schools of Buddhism, or it was just one of the schools of Buddhism that had been growing in the last 1,000 years since the Buddha's death. This was the pointing to them directly at the mind school that became known as the just sitting school, the school outside of the scriptures. So certainly Buddha gave a lot of lectures that were ultimately written down out of memory of his dedicated disciples after his death. And those were considered scriptures. And then in the 1,000 years after the Buddha, other scriptures were composed, inspired by the Buddha, or maybe Buddha gave lectures to individuals that were ultimately written down and called scriptures, but the brand of Buddhism that Bodhidharma championed and taught was Buddhism outside of the scriptures, just pointing at the mind, just sitting and getting to know this mind. And It certainly thrived in China, and about 800 years after that, Dogen started practicing that, and we have continued Dogen's interpretation of just sitting, and this Buddhism outside of the scriptures. So this person probably existed, and because it was 1500 years ago, maybe not everything he said was written down. So only these four lectures have really been attributed to Bodhidharma, and maybe they weren't his at all, but maybe they were inspired by his teaching. Bodhidharma famously met Emperor Wu, who said, you know, what's the holiest thing? And his answer was, nothing holy. Maybe that happened. And it's a pretty good teaching. And it continues to this day. Maybe Bodhidharma invented Kung Fu, which is also attributed to Bodhidharma. Maybe he was 150 years old during his invention of Kung Fu, which was also one of the stories that he was pretty old in this journey. And he sat in a cave near the Shaolin Temple in southern China for 9 years with a very intense meditation. And let's all agree that the myth that he got sleepy, so that in order to stay awake, he ripped off his eyelids and threw them into the field next to the cave so that he wouldn't fall asleep. Let's agree that that's a myth, and that where those eyelids landed were the first tea leaves that grew up, you know, that helps us stay awake. Let's all agree that that's a myth. You know, talk about the undying person in the hut. You know, nobody really knows when he was born or when he died. It is written down. He had four heirs, four Dharma heirs, from the famous story, the famous transmission story, where he says to one of his students, "You have my skin." Another student, "You have my bones." Another student, "You have my flesh." And another student says, "You have my marrow." So this transmission is about, the teacher recognizes her very essence in the disciples. So he had four heirs, and we, you know, this is all about lineage. We have descended from his heir, Weka. Weka may have wanted to. Wakeham may have had a hard time convincing Bodhidharma of his sincerity. Maybe we should all agree that this is a myth. That he tried so hard to show how sincere he was that he cut off his arm. I'm willing to say that that's a myth. Not that anybody told me, but it's just too hard to think about. When I came to this temple, I just had to postpone my dinner date a little later. You know, it wasn't so hard to get into this temple. I just had to say, I'm going to be a little late for dinner. But we came from our lineage was passed down through the Waka. And Waka's disciple, who probably also studied alongside of Bodhidharma, was just younger, and was officially a disciple of Waka. But this disciple of Waka wrote things down, and Waka wrote down that, or the disciple of Waka, whose name I forget, like Tamlin or Tamsin, wrote down that. Pardon me? Okay, thank you. Wrote down that Bodhidharma was killed. Maybe in some sort of political extermination of a certain territory. And then another, independent of this disciple, was another account that there was a Buddhist monk killed in this extermination. So maybe sometime in the mid-500s, Bodhidharma died there in China. But another story about Bodhidharma is that years later, he was seen again and approached and said that he was, you know, going back to India. So somebody saw him, recognized him as Bodhidharma, who was going back to China. And interestingly, he was only walking with one shoe. And so they went to this tomb where Bodhidharma had been buried after the political extermination, after the genocide of a certain people in China. They went back to his tomb and it was empty. Let's agree that this is a myth. It was empty except for one shoe. So that's the extent of it. It's got some real teachings involved in it. It's embedded in our practice of Buddhism, and there's a lot of good stories that might inspire us, even though we say that these stories are in the realm of myth. We're finishing up here, and I want us to remember. Our practice of meeting the truth in this practice, rather than seeking the truth. And I think maybe all of us can remember when we first started our spiritual practice and settling into our spiritual practice, how big mind grew in us. And we can talk more about that in tomorrow's lecture. May our journey with one shoe bring us towards the undying person in our hut, bring us towards the path of practice, the path of Bodhidharma. May this one-shoed practice be our practice throughout eternity. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to undo them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.